This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will have interviews that we will not take phone calls for with Paul Pascoff, the retired history professor from Louisiana State University. He spent 36 years at the Old War School, and he remembers Richard Milhouse Nixon, who on this date 40 years ago announced that he would resign the presidency the following day. Also, Vincent Bugliosi, the amazing prosecutor who put Charles Manson behind bars and wrote about it in Helter Skelter, remembers 45 years ago tonight, Sharon Tate was throwing a party at her house in Bel Air, and the end was not nice. We'll talk with Vincent Bugliosi about the Manson murders and why people are still immersed in this subject 4½ decades later. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to WRKF, and we start a show today with Paul Pascoff. For 36 years, he was a professor of history at Louisiana State University, taught many people, including yours truly, and he arrived at LSU in the fall of 1976, and it was 40 years ago tonight that President Richard Milhouse Nixon, the 37th American president, resigned in disgrace amid the Watergate scandal, and left the office of the presidency early in his second term, leaving the reins to Gerald Rudolph Ford. And Nixon is one of those figures, like him or loathe him, he was one of the most profound people of the 20th century. Good morning, Paul Pascoff.
Good morning.
The man from Yorba Linda, born January 9th, 1913, he left an indelible mark on the American political scene, and also he was an active president.
Yes, he was, and in part, I think it was his actions as president, but more importantly, the manner in which he left the presidency that have continued to influence our politics today, including the public's conception of the presidency.
Well, Richard Nixon was a man who was known to many Americans for a very long time. He was elected vice president in 1952. But always seemed to be embroiled in controversy. Going back to the Checkers speech in 52 and the Hiss case before that, he was always embroiled in some sort of controversy, and it ended with 22 years after the vice presidential quest with resignation and disgrace. Was it a surprise that he screwed up so profoundly as president?
Well, you know, in retrospect, I suppose with, you know, 2020 hindsight, whatever cliche one wanted to apply, it seemed that the pattern had been set early in his political career. But, yeah, I think most people were quite surprised. He seemed to be the master politician. And what was particularly surprising in light of the revelations of Watergate was that 1972, without any dirty tricks, without any of the law-breaking and the other acts, Nixon was going to cruise to re-election. But part and parcel of the Watergate affair, as it was collectively, you know, described, there was the sabotage of Edmund Muskie's candidacy for the Democratic nomination, mm-hmm. The thinking being that, it was revealed, that Muskie would be a far more formidable candidate against Nixon's bid for re-election than would, say, somebody like George McGovern. So the infamous Canuck letter, the Canuck letter, purportedly written, Muskie's doing, using a pejorative term for French Canadians, many of whom lived up in Maine, from which Muskie hailed, it was a palpable forgery. But it reduced, then attacks on Muskie's wife reduced Muskie to tears on the hustings. Friends of his claimed that, no, it was the cold air that made his eyes smart, but he also choked up when talking about his wife. Well, he was out, and George McGovern, who, however admirable in many respects, was a very weak candidate, and that's exactly what the Nixon political machine wanted. So they got it.
And McGovern carried one state, not his home state, by the way. It was Massachusetts. He lost in South Dakota, his home state, and he lost every other state. And he was a war hero who was portrayed as a wimp rather effectively by the Nixon campaign apparatus, and that's the same apparatus that was involved in Watergate. Nixon, he became quite adept, or maybe not so adept, at dirty tricks.
Well, you know, the sobriquet applied to Nixon was Tricky Dicky, or Tricky Dick, and it went all the way back, at least as far as national politics were concerned, it went all the way back to the Checkers affair, as you pointed out, with that speech that Nixon gave, that pathetic speech, which most people who watched him give it in the radio studio were convinced was, you know, they were witnessing the self-destruction of a national candidate for the Republican, for vice president on the Republican ticket. And yet the calls, the radio station was inundated by favorable calls talking about how Nixon had integrity and courage and that he was defending his wife and his children. And that was the Checkers speech in 52. And then there was his failed bid for the governorship of California against Pat Brown, the father of the current governor of California. And the American television public got to watch the meltdown of a political figure as he said, you won't have Nixon to kick around.
All right, hold that thought. That's 1962, and Nixon, mind you, he survived the Checkers scandal and was elected vice president, served two terms, and then lost a razor-thin race to John Kennedy for the presidency in 1960. And he's trying to come back politically, runs for governor of California in 62 against the incumbent Pat Brown, father of the current governor of California, and lost to Pat Brown. And Nixon waited until the wee hours of the morning, obviously fatigued, perhaps drinking a bit as well, and finally comes out to meet the press corps, at that time an all-white male press corps, frustrated at Nixon's lengthy evening, keeping them up late, but they were ready, pen and microphones in hand. And here's how it sounded when Richard Milhouse Nixon came before the throng in Los Angeles in 1962 to accept defeat.
I'm proud of the fact that I defended my opponent's patriotism. You gentlemen didn't report it, but I'm proud that I did that. I want that for once, gentlemen. I would appreciate if you would write what I'm saying in that respect. And as I leave the press, all I can say is this. For 16 years, ever since the Hiss case, you've had a lot of fun. You've had an opportunity to attack me, and I think I've given as good as I've taken. Last point. I leave you gentlemen now, and you will now write it, you will interpret it, that's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference, and I hope that what I have said today will at least make television, radio, the press recognize that they have a right and a responsibility that if they're against a candidate, give him the shaft. But also recognize if they give him the shaft, put one lonely reporter on the campaign who will report what the candidate says now and then. Thank you, gentlemen, and good day.
Richard Nixon was 49 years old. How in the world did he survive that?
I don't know. It just seems, you know, just coincidentally that about every 10 years he got himself in a situation. 52, 62, 72. Of course, the chickens came home to roost in 74, but
the break-in was in 72.
The break-in was in 72, and the first reporting by Woodward and Bernstein was in 72, but of course, most the media was not listening or reading what they wrote, or at least not approving of what they wrote. But about every 10 years, Nixon seemed to have a mini meltdown, and of course, 74, he had a complete meltdown. But there was always something unsavory surrounding him. Eisenhower was ready to kick him off the ticket in 52 and told him that it was the Checkers speech, there's make or break. And Eisenhower didn't have the text in advance. In 62, Well, I should say that in 72, there were many people saying that if it was typical of Nixon that you couldn't take him at his word in 62 when he said that this would be his last press mm-hmm. conference. He arose, you know, he rose again.
To think how he aged. He was 39 when he was elected vice president, 49 when he lost the governorship of California, and only 61 when he departed the presidency and looked much older. And he announced on August 8th, 1974, 40 years ago tonight, that the following day he would be leaving the Oval Office.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour.
President Ford took the oath, and then a month later he pardoned Richard Nixon and probably lost any bid he had to be elected president. He lost a close race to Jimmy Carter. If not for the pardon of Nixon, quite likely Gerald Rudolph Ford would have been the president of the United States for 6 years rather than 2 years.
Well, you know, that's certainly my suspicion, but Ford was weakened by Reagan in Ford's
primary
bid
in 76.
Right, and the extent to which Reagan's actions contributed to Ford's defeat are difficult, obviously, impossible for me to assess. I'm not primarily a political historian. I actually defer to my wife in this, and she's not a political historian either, but she's got a lot of savvy, and she said in 76 with regard to Jimmy Carter's candidacy, you know, Jimmy who? Obviously, nobody thought that a Democrat could beat Ford. Mm-hmm. In 76.
Well, Carter won a close race, and he did so by carrying the solid South. Imagine that, a Democrat carrying states where Democrats can't win today, Louisiana.
Right, last time.
1976, James Earl Carter defeated Gerald Ford, but Richard Nixon was around for much longer than either Ford or Carter on the national and international scene. What are his greatest accomplishments, if you will?
Well, in terms positively, I think one would say the opening to China, which only somebody with Nixon's anti-communist credentials probably could have pulled off. It's difficult to understand, especially for people too young to have lived through that period as adults. It's difficult to understand just what a hot button, a hot button word, communism was, and the most damning indictment one could offer of an American politician was that he or she was soft on communism. Well, opening diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China, as Nixon did, would have been political suicide for virtually anybody else. So I'd say that changed our world. He did pledge in 68 that he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. What is often overlooked is that in his first year as president, in 69, that was the year of the most intense American fighting in Vietnam, with the, in proportion of troops engaged, the highest rate of casualties. So before he ended the war, he intensified it. And of course, he bombed in Cambodia, secret bombing campaign, which many Democrats in Congress and a growing number of Republicans believed was an abuse of presidential power.
But so, he was an active president.
He was, and he left his mark, and I'm afraid, however, that his admirers' belief that someday history will be kinder to Nixon than journalists were that remark would have to be qualified by the observation that I think most people are going to remember that he is the only president to have resigned certainly in disgrace.
And he did so because he was certain to be impeached and convicted. He did not have the votes in the House or the Senate.
The Republican leadership in the Senate assured him that he had 15 votes at most. And in the House, it was proportionally worse.
Well, thank you, Paul Pascoff. Good to visit with you as always. No longer teaching at LSU, but you left a mark as well. Maybe a more positive one than Richard Nixon did.
I hope so.
and we shall return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest at this time is perhaps the most famous prosecutor in American history, Vincent Bugliosi, a man who became a best-selling author. It all started with Helter Skelter, the true story of the Manson murders. That printing was 40 years ago, and it was 45 years ago tonight that Sharon Tate had her last night on this earth in Los Angeles, California, when she was brutally killed by the Manson gang. And the prosecutor was Vincent Bugliosi. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. It's always a pleasure being on your show. You're unquestionably one of the top radio talk show hosts in the entire country, and so I'm happy to be on your show again.
45 years ago. Does it seem like it's been that long?
No. The old cliched term that time travels very, very fast. It does seem a long time ago, but not 45 years ago. I mean, it seems more like, you know, 25, 30, 35 years, but 45 years, that's almost a half a century.
It is, and it is something that lives with us for those who were alive and even those who were not, vividly to this day. Why are we so fascinated with what happened in California on that night 4.5 decades ago?
Well, Jim, I think there are many reasons why people continue to be fascinated by this case, not just in the United States, but around the world, actually. If I were to single out one reason above all the others, and there are so many, and I can touch on a lot of them, it's probably because it's the most bizarre mass murder case in the recorded annals of American crime. And for whatever reason, Jim, people tend to be fascinated by things that are strange and bizarre. If these murders had never happened and someone had written a fiction novel with the same set of facts and circumstances, you'd probably put it down after a couple pages because, as I understand it, to be good fiction, it's got to be somewhat believable. And this is just too far out. You know, we're talking about the bottomless pit in the desert. We're talking about the Bible. We're talking about the Beatles. We're talking about the motive to ignite a war between blacks and whites. At the murder scene, they print words from Beatles songs, mind you, in blood. Who are the killers? Kids from average American homes with fairly good backgrounds, totally different from what we would expect of mass murderers. We also have the fact that these people may have murdered, Jim, as many as 35 people. At least that's the number that they use. Manson's been convicted of 9 murders. But the family, that was his group, used to say, we offed, O-F-F-E-D, 35 people. They already had plans, and this all adds into the bizarreness of it. They already had plans to murder people like Frank Sinatra, Liz Taylor, Richard Burton, Steve McQueen, Tom Jones. The tremendous brutality of the murders, although we've had murders even more brutal than the Manson murders, but when you combine it with everything else, it makes it just unbelievable. There were 169 stab wounds and 7 gunshot wounds and 2 nights of murder. You know, the first night the Tate murders, the next night the LaBianca murders. And I think we have to add something here as to why we're still talking about this case. The very name Manson, Jim, has become almost a metaphor for evil. And that has catapulted him to almost mythological proportions. He's come to represent the dark and malignant side of humanity, and for whatever reason, again, people seem to be fascinated by pure, unalloyed evil. Evil has its allure. Witness the continuing fascination with Hitler, who incidentally was Manson's biggest hero. But Hitler, Jack the Ripper, Manson. Let me give you one example of Manson's name being used as a metaphor, and it comes up constantly, radio, TV, newspapers, everything. But I'll just give you one example. Mike Tyson was reapplying for a boxing license in Nevada, and he said, listen, I'm a bad guy, but I'm not Charles Manson. Also, there are these sociological implications of this murder. Most murders don't have any implications beyond the horrible act. Not so with the Manson case. It took place during the so-called decade of love, the 1960s, and Joan Didion, you probably heard of her in her memoirs, The White Album, she said that many people believe that the so-called decade of love came to an end abruptly on the night of August the 9th, 1969. ABC's Diane Sawyer said something changed in the heart of America with the Manson murders. You see, Jim, going all the way back, prior to the Manson murders, hippies were not associated with violence and murder. They were associated with drugs, free love, peace, etc. Then the Manson family comes along looking like hippies, living like hippies. But as you know, Jim, they were mass murderers. That was their religion, their cradle. They wanted to kill as many people as they could. And that shocked America, particularly when Americans found out who these young kids were from average American homes. There was a sense that they could have been the children of any parents in America. Now, it's a very, very long answer to your question, but I think in the amalgam, the case was just so bizarre it wouldn't even make good fiction, and that's why we're still talking about it 45 years later.
Do you find a curiosity or an irony in that you were born August 1934, and a few months later, Charlie Manson was born, both sons of the Midwest, and then you converge in Los Angeles, obviously, on two different missions at the same time and same place?
Yeah, other people have noticed that irony. They've also noted, and respect is probably a bad word because it connotes something good, but you could say that you respected Adolf Hitler as a leader. You certainly did not like anything he did. But with respect to Manson and me, and maybe the better word would be acknowledge, we both acknowledged the other or respected the other. I respected him as a heavyweight in the world of crime, if you can call that respect. And he, from the witness stand, said that that I was a genius. So I think we each viewed each other as worthy opponents. Here's someone who did not participate in these murders. Not because he wasn't capable of murder. It's not like Heinrich Himmler supposedly at Auschwitz when he saw blood, he fainted. Manson's very, very capable of murder, and we could get into that if you want me to. But I think he deliberately got other people to do his bidding for him, so he thought he would immunize himself from criminal responsibility. And as it turned out, it was much more difficult convicting him since he did not participate in these murders. And to this very day, there's a cover story on Manson, whether Eminem is one, and he's another cover story, same edition of the, I think it was the December edition of Rolling Stone. And to this day, he's saying, I didn't kill anybody. And he didn't. I didn't kill anybody. How can you put me behind bars when I didn't kill anybody? Well, my response to that is that if Hitler were at Nuremberg, how would he have sounded if he said, well, I didn't kill anybody? I mean, obviously, if you're a part of a conspiracy to commit a crime, each member of the conspiracy, and here Manson was the architect of the conspiracy, each member is criminally responsible for all acts committed by their co-conspirators. He's the one that ordered and masterminded these murders. But he's still bleeding out, or whatever the word is, I didn't kill anybody. Well, I've never said he did. Well, he did participate in other crimes. At least one other murder that we know about, tried to kill someone else, thought he had killed them, and saw them at the county jail walking, and he did a double take because he thought the guy was dead. But no, he didn't kill anybody, but he's responsible for those murders.
Mm-hmm. Benson Bugliosi is the guest, the author of Helter Skelter. That term, of course, became part of the American lexicon after you wrote the best-selling book with a gentleman, Kurt Gentry, who just passed away.
Yeah, poor Kurt just died. He was a great writer and also a great historian. And I couldn't have done Helter Skelter without Kurt. And as you know, it became the biggest-selling best true crime book in publishing history. In Cold Blood is number two.
How did you get on the case?
Well, I was assigned the case. You know, I was assigned the case, and you have to realize, I don't want to boast, but you have to realize that if you've got a big case like this, the DA doesn't just put his hand into a hat and pull out a name. I had risen, was considered to be the top prosecutor in the office. I'd only been in the office for 5 years. Usually a case like this, a big case, is considered a plum, a prosecutorial plum, and it's given to prosecutors have been in the office for 20, 25 years. Like the Sirhan case, there were three prosecutors on that case, all of whom had more than 20 years experience. But for whatever reason, I rose to the top of the office. At the end of only about three and a half years, there was already a series, a Jack Webb TV series called The DA, and actor Robert Conrad patterned his role after me, followed me around the courts, and came to the home. His favorite dinner was my wife's stew. So I don't know. I guess for whatever reason, I rose to the top of the office. I think it was the London Times said that the LADA's office threw its heaviest gun at Manson. You asked me a question which requires my saying favorable things about me, but I don't know how else to answer it, except to tell you they're not going to pick a name out of a hat.
But did you know much about the case when you were assigned to it?
Well, not really. I was assigned to this case, not immediately. I was assigned the first moment that the Manson family became suspects. Before that, I knew about the case. I mean, it was a story on page one. It was a front page story. And no one knew who the Manson, not the Manson, no one knew who the Tate LaBianca killers were. But it was a huge, huge story. There were people coming back from Europe saying that the Manson case was a bigger story over there than Chappaquiddick was. And we all know about Chappaquiddick. One reason, of course, is that Sharon Tate's, one of the victims, her husband was Roman Polanski, a pretty famous director. One of the victims, Wojciech Frykowski, was from Poland. But it was a huge, huge case. The world media covered it. It was the biggest case that the LADA's office had ever had up to that point. Since that time, there's been the Simpson case, which in terms of publicity was even bigger than the Manson case.
Well, in that half month that you speak of, Ted Kennedy was in a car accident in which Mary Jo Kopechne died. A man, Neil Armstrong, landed on the moon. And then we have the Manson killings. And it's
and
hard.
Woodstock, too,
and,
I think.
And Woodstock as well. You're right. And it's
yeah,
hard.
It's incredible, that summer of 69, yeah.
It's hard to find a more sympathetic victim than Sharon Tate, one of the most beautiful women ever, and she was 8 months pregnant.
8.5 months pregnant, right. And she told Susan Atkins, although Susan Atkins has since refused to say it on the witness stand, but she said, please let me live so I can have my baby. And Susan Atkins told me when she was cooperating, and then she went back to her god, Charles Manson, and I couldn't use anything she said. But she told me, look, bitch, I don't have any mercy on you. You're going to die, you know. And poor Sharon's mother, Doris, she's dead now. She told me more than once, she said, every day I hear and I see Sharon begging for her life to have her baby. Sharon had a baby bassinet in her room, freshly wrapped in cellophane, and it was on top of an armoire so she could look at it. She was just living to have that child. She stopped drinking coffee and everything, and she was brutally murdered, 16 stab wounds. When I was mentioning all the things that add up to the bizarreness of it, the victims were not huge, but, I mean, Sharon Tate was on the threshold of stardom. Abigail Folger was the heiress to the coffee forge fortune, and then there was the internationally famous hairstylist Jay Sebring. When you add everything up, it was just something that would not make good fiction.
And in a place where these things usually don't occur.
Yeah, Bel Air. Yeah, it was an expensive home, secluded at the top of a long, winding road. Bel Air's one of the most expensive areas in the entire country, and they don't have murders there. I can't think of another one that's happened in Bel Air, although there may have been. I don't know.
And at first, Manson was, as you know, not a suspect. We didn't know who did it, but he quickly became one. And he had been to that house before, hadn't he?
Yeah, I have to say it was a direct result of my own personal investigation. I helped the LAPD. I joined in the investigation. Most prosecutors, that's not their job. Their job is to present an evidence, present into evidence, evidence gathered by law enforcement agencies. But I've always not lived up, but I never felt restricted by that. And I used to go out into the field myself, and the Manson case was a classic example. And as a result of my investigation, I put Manson inside the gates, the gate of the Tate residence about 4 months before the murders. It had never believed he had ever been there. Not only did I put him inside the gate, but when he knocked on the door, Sharon Tate's photographer, Shayrock Hatami, came to the door, kind of booted him off the premises. But anyway, before that happened, and while Manson was still at the door, poor Sharon came to the door and said, "Who is it, Hatami?" And there's no question that Manson and Sharon must have looked into each other's eyes. And that was about 4 months before he sent his killers there to the former home of Terry Melcher, Terry Melcher's Doris Day's son. He wasn't living there anymore, but he sent them to the former home of Terry Melcher with instructions to murder everyone on the premises and make the murders as brutal as possible.
And he thought he was going to precipitate a race war by doing this. How in the world did he think that?
Well, I don't believe he thought he could precipitate. Well, he told his family, you know, Helter Skelter was the last final destructive war in the face of this earth among men, according to Manson. And his family, the killers, bought what he said, hook, line, and sinker. Do I believe that Manson believed all of Helter Skelter? I don't know the answer, but my belief is that he did not. I do believe he thought he might be able to bring about a riot in L.A. between blacks and whites. Just a couple months earlier, they had had the Watts riots. I don't believe he thought that that riot was going to end up all over the world. I don't believe he believed that. I don't believe he believed in the bottomless pit in the desert where supposedly he was going to take his family during Helter Skelter. I do believe that he felt that the Beatles were sending out hidden messages to him and other tuned-in people beneath the lyrics of their songs. For instance, they had a song called Revolution One. And it was in that White Album that came out in December 1968. And Manson came back to the ranch. He was all excited. He used to say that, I'm not going to use the word here, but something is coming down. And then he said, the Beatles are telling it like it is. Helter Skelter is coming down. He substituted the word Helter Skelter for this other word. In any event, Revolution One, I'm just giving you an example, because Manson used to play that album over and over and over again, listening for hidden messages. The Beatles say, you say there's going to be a revolution, but if there's going to be destruction, you can count me out. But Manson heard, and he's correct, it is there. If you listen very, very carefully, after the word in, very quietly, you hear the word in. So he told his family that the Beatles were once undecided, but now they want a violent revolution.
We shall return with more from the incomparable Vincent Bugliosi after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we continue our discussion with Vincent Bugliosi, the remarkable prosecutor from Los Angeles who became a best-selling author. He wrote about his life and times in Helter Skelter, the trial that he is synonymous with, the one that put Charlie Manson in jail for the rest of his life. Vincent Bugliosi lost only one case in a long and distinguished career as a prosecutor. He turns 80 years old on the 18th day of August. He's battled health problems in recent years, but he remains feisty when he talks about Charlie Manson and what it took to put this madman behind bars. Vincent Bugliosi on the oddness of Charles Manson.
I don't even think you see things like this, Jim, in horror movies. Young people, teenage girls, early 20s, dressed in black, armed with sharp knives, going into the homes of total strangers in the middle of the night and mercilessly stabbing them to death. I'm not sure they have that in horror movies. It's just so, it's so freaky. One thing that a lot of people have forgotten, or maybe they never knew, I asked for the death penalty against these people. And I told the jury, if this is not a proper case for the imposition of the death penalty, no case ever would be. I also challenged them and said, if they were unwilling to come back with a verdict of death in this case, then we should abolish the death penalty in the state of California. I mean, why have it on the book if this is not a proper case? And the thing that some people have forgotten is that the jury did return verdicts of death against all of these killers, Manson and his co-defendants. And I'll tell you about a conversation I had with Manson. I told him at the beginning of the trial, I said, Charlie, I'm going to convict you, but after you get a fair trial. At the end of the trial, the jury wasn't there at all, but there were a lot of people in the courtroom, and he and I were talking, and he said that I gave him a fair trial. And we used to have kind of sarcastic conversations, and he said to me, you know, Bugliosi, you think you've accomplished a lot, but all you've done is send me back to where I came from. And that was true to a certain extent. When he got out of prison at the age of 32, Jim, 17 out of those 32 years had been spent in jails, reformatories, and prisons. So he was totally institutionalized. And I made a sarcastic remark to him, yeah, Charlie, but as far as I know, you haven't been in the green room before. The green room is the Apple Green Room at San Quentin, where they have the gas chamber, and he just smiled, although he claims to have been resurrected. In any event, a year later, I'm in my car radio on, and I hear the U.S. Supreme Court, Furman versus Georgia, ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional, not per se, but the way it was being implemented by the states. They made the ruling retroactive. Everyone on death row around the country, there were a little over 600 people, including the Manson and his co-defendants. All of their death penalty sentences, Jim, were irreversibly reduced from death down to life. In any event, the first thought that came into my mind when I heard that, I said, you know, what he told me is right. All I've done is send him back to where he came from. And I hate to say it, but I have to be candid. In a sense, Manson has beaten the rap. He's beaten the rap because he doesn't mind prison life. He learned to like life on the outside a little better with his harem of girls and riding dune buggies up and down the desert. But he's totally institutionalized. He's got his guitar. Did you know, Jim, that he recorded behind bars? I don't know how he pulled it off. Two musical albums. He gets more letters than any other inmate, according to the LA Times, and U.S. prison history. He's been selling a lock of his hair for $500. He gets his three meals a day in medical care. So he gets out in 67, may have murdered 35 people, at least 9, and we just sent him back home. I don't have any answer to that or how it could have been any different than it turned out being, but I'm just telling you that in a sense, Manson has beaten the rap.
Was he always a monster?
Oh, boy, that's a good question, Jim. I don't think so. Up to the time that we know he was a monster, most of his crimes were kind of petty crimes, and unfortunately for him, they were federal crimes. And in the federal system, they send you to a penitentiary longer than in states where they send you to the state prison. Things like forgery and stuff like that, stealing from the mail, and he really never had any history of violence. The first crime he committed, we were aware he committed, burglarized a grocery store at the age of 12, committed armed robbery at the age of 13. But one thing is very, very obvious, even back then, he had a tremendous hostility towards society, and I don't think there's any question that he used his minions, his followers, to vent his spleen for him on society. One reason he hated society, well, I'll give you two quick ones. One, there's no question he had a deprived youth. You know, his mother, he called her a prostitute, but I think she was more loose than being a prostitute. But she lived with a succession of uncles, and she'd disappear for a couple days, at least she told him that, and all of a sudden she's gone for a couple months. And she served 3 years for armed robbery herself with her uncle, who's now a Methodist minister. Anyway, anyway, so people say, well, you know, he had this terrible, terrible youth. Yeah, but there's, I don't know, millions, but hundreds of thousands of people have had a youth similar to his, Jim, and they don't turn out to be, as you say, monsters. Some people are just bad human beings, and there's no question in my mind he's a bad human being. The other reason, of course, that he had this hostility, he used to look up the Beatles. He thought they were prophets, but he said, if I'm given a chance, I can do better than they did. He wanted to be a recording star. And Terry Melcher was a record producer, came out to Spahn Ranch to audition Manson, wasn't very impressed, gave him $50 and left. And that's why he went back to the Tate residence looking for Melcher. And he was told that Melcher no longer lived there, but he wanted to prevail upon Melcher again. So he was turned down by the establishment, and he had a tremendous hatred for them. It's funny, I've had people say, well, you know, Mr. Bugliosi, if he had gotten his recording contract, these murders would never have happened. And I think they're right, actually. But I've responded that if someone had bought Hitler's paintings in Vienna in 1913, maybe we wouldn't have had the Second World War, you know, that but-for type of causation.
How did these young people fall sway to his influence?
Boy, you ask good questions, Jim. You're up to your old tricks, asking tough questions that are tough to answer. How did they fall sway to him? Well, for one thing, Jim, you have to realize that Manson had the raw material to work with. Just like water seeks its own level, each group tends to seek its own kind. Every member of Manson's family, before they met him, had already dropped out of society. Most of them had been involved very heavily in the use of psychedelic drugs. So he had the raw material to work with. With that raw material, Jim, I'll try to summarize because you're asking tough questions that cannot be answered in a couple words. Well, one of the first things he did, Jim, to get control of them, he tried to subvert their sexuality. A new girl joining the family, he would induce her to have sex with another girl, boy with a boy, and it was pretty obvious what he was trying to do. He was trying to remove their ego and their pride. When they had sex orgies, he orchestrated like a maestro what everyone else was doing. He also used drugs very effectively. The main drugs were marijuana and LSD. Time magazine said that the killers were wild on LSD on these two nights of murder, but they were not. Manson wanted his killers to be as effective as possible, and you don't send someone out to commit mass murder and first give them a tab of LSD. They probably couldn't even find the place where they're supposed to go. But LSD played a role in getting these people to the point where they were willing to kill for him. Those who have used LSD, Jim, and there's been scholars who have written on the subject matter of LSD, they describe it as a mind-altering, a mind-expanding drug. It's a little difficult for someone like me to know exactly what they're talking about, but they do say something that's more relevant to this case. They say when you're on an LSD trip, you're much more vulnerable and susceptible to the influence of third parties. And Manson went on many LSD trips with his family, 2, 3, 4, 5 a week, very cleverly. Either he took no LSD himself or a smaller dosage of LSD than they did so he could retain more control over his mental faculties. And while they were on these trips, he would dig down very deeply into their psyche and try to remove many of their longstanding convictions on life. I would say the main reason how these people fell prey to him and how he got control over them is simply preaching to his family on a day-to-day basis in an isolated setting. The isolation of the setting is very important. Most of the preaching would take place at night when they would have their vegetarian dinner around the campfire. Manson would sit alone on top of a big rock, play his guitar, philosophize on life. No one else, they were all in a circle around him. No one else would talk unless he spoke to them first. But in answer to your question, I would say The three main techniques he used to gain control was to subvert their sexuality, drugs, and preaching to them on a day-to-day basis. And these are kind of conventional ways to gain control over people. Now, he did get a little sophisticated. He said, listen, these people you're killing, don't look upon them as being decent human beings. Look upon them as being symbols of a sick society. They can only be cured by a violent revolution. And perhaps psychologically, it's easier to stab a symbol than it is to stab a human being. Probably one thing more than anything else, it's an intangible that enabled him to gain control, was simply the power. I mean, it's implied in everything that I've said, the power of Manson's personality, the evil genius of Charles Manson. I'm not talking about his IQ, although that wasn't low. It was fairly high. I think it was 121 at the age of 19. But when I talk about the power of his personality, the evil genius, I'm talking about the ability he seemed to have, Jim, to immediately discern in other people what they wanted to see in him, and then put on a separate face for each person. By his own admission, he said, I am a man of 1,000 faces. He's constantly changing to fit the occasion or the person to whom he was talking. In his ability to detect weaknesses and fears in people and exploit those weaknesses and fears, I'd have to call him a genius. One important point that I want to add to everything I've told you as a footnote, you talk about how these people fell sway to him. Several did not, Jim, and they were just as subservient to him as those who killed for him. They would have died for him, but they would not kill for him. E.g., Linda Kasabian, my star witness, second night of murders. He drops the killers off the La Bianca residence. He goes down to Venice off the Pacific Ocean, stops in an apartment house, and gives Linda a knife, tells her to go inside the apartment house and murder an actor friend of hers whom she had met a couple weeks earlier hitchhiking up Pacific Coast Highway. And Linda, who was a true hippie, a flower child, thought Manson was Jesus, said, Charlie, I'm not you. I cannot kill anybody. Anyway, he persisted, and she frustrated what would have been an eighth murder in two nights by deliberately knocking on the wrong door. And there were other members of Manson's family who were just as subservient to him as the killers, but they would not kill for him. So how do you distinguish? The only thing I can think of is that those that killed for him either had murder already coursing through their veins, but I'll stipulate, and I want to add this very quickly, these murders would never have taken place had it not been for Charles Manson. But I think the ones that killed for him had a deep hostility towards society, some of them even their own parents. And he never told them, either you kill for me or I'm going to kill you. If he had done that, Jim, I would not have asked for the death penalty against the actual killers. I would have sought a conviction of first-degree murder and life imprisonment, but not the death penalty. But he didn't tell them that. Look, he told Linda to kill for him. She didn't do it. He didn't do anything to her. And he knew, he found out later, that she knocked on the wrong door. Those that killed for him, Jim, in my opinion, already had murder in their system or hostility, and he was the catalyst that brought it to the surface. But the multiplicity of stab wounds, Jim, 169, some of them post-mortem. You know what I mean by post-mortem? The victim's already dead and they continue to stab. Shows that those that killed for Manson were willing participants in these murders. If we're to believe psychiatrists, some people have more of a homicidal tendency than others. Let me give you an example of a very prevalent state of mind in the Manson family at the time of these murders. First night, he sends his killers directly to the Tate residence, stays back at the ranch himself. Second night, they go looking for their victims completely at random in L.A. They even stopped at a church. They were going to murder everyone in the church, but the doors were locked. In any event, as they were getting into the car that night out at Spahn Ranch, There were quite a few in the car, and there wasn't any room for anyone else. 17-year-old girl, what was her name, Catherine Gillis, she wants to come along, and she can't, there's no room, and she says, I want to get myself a couple pigs. Very, very relevant, prevalent state of mind in the Manson family. It's a complex case, Jim. I mean, and you ask tough questions, and I can't answer them in a short thing. I can only give you a lot of circumstantial evidence from which we have to draw inferences.
There's nobody like you. Hope you have a great birthday later this month.
Okay, thank you so much, Jim. It's always an honor being on your show.
Thank you, sir. We'll talk again. Let's hope.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. And that's it for today. Until next time, I'm Jim Inkster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.